Well, we're glad you're here. I was thinking I could unhook this, and I'm just going to have to get me a ladder. There we go. Thank you. Kent and I, we may have to stand apart from each other.
Yeah.
Keep from Raymond. Kent and I are both at Abilene Christian University working on working with a team that's trying to figure out how ACU can best support efforts in church planning. I'm not a church planner. I've done congregational ministry quite a bit, but I've never planted a church. So I'm mostly the caddy today for the real church planner on our team, who is Kent. But I am passionate about what church planning can bring to our movement. And I have some things I want to say along those lines. But we're hoping that what we do today is raise the bar a little in terms of vision and appreciation for why we need to have people dreaming and thinking and praying about church planning. And I don't know if you've become more aware, I have in the last few years, that church planning is increasingly a topic that people are talking about. And it seems like everywhere you turn, there's a conference on church planning or some big new initiative in church planning started. Kent, what's the fuss all about here? Why are people talking about this so much?
Well, Mark, thanks for asking that question. That's a great question.
Yeah, just play along with us, would you, as we do.
There is a lot of attention on church planning these days, and there are a lot of good answers to that question, but I want to just touch on three for our purposes here. I think one of the reasons people are interested in church planting is because of where we are in churches in North America, not just churches of Christ, but churches in general. I think another reason is because more and more people are becoming aware of what the end in sight is, what the long-term purposes of God are, and how church planting relates to that. And I think a third thing I would say is that a lot of folks are getting more aware of what it's going to take for us to get from here to there. So let me just kind of take those piece by piece and hit them for just a couple of minutes. Where we are in North America in terms of churches is we're in trouble. We're in serious trouble, and one way to illustrate that is to notice what researcher George Barna had to say about a seven-day period recently when they found out that 31 million people had gone to church in the previous 7 days who are U.S. From North America, from the USA, that were Protestants, 31 million. And another 30 million were in church that were Catholic. So you guys help me do the math here. Right now, the U.S. Census Bureau says there are 293 million people in the U.S. 293 million. There were 31 million Protestants, 30 million Catholics, so 61 million were in church during that seven-day period. Okay, so 293 minus 61, what is that? 232. 232 million people that were not in church during that seven-day period. Now you say, well, Kent, but there was probably some good Christian people that weren't in church during that seven-day period, and no doubt that's true. But I think it's probably arguable also that there were probably quite a few people in church that weren't really truly faithful believers. So I don't know what the wash is. God knows that. I'm not worried about nailing that down. But the net result is that we're dealing basically with a nation where maybe one person in five or so is actually seriously involved in church attendance. Now, we're not talking discipleship, passionate commitment to Jesus at this point. We're talking about church attendance. So that's a significant reality, I think, and it brings us to the good news and some sad news. The good news is that last decade, the fastest growing major Christian group was our sister churches in the conservative Christian church. They grew by 17% in the 1990s. And that was faster than all the other major Christian groups in North America. Now, the truth is that the population of the United States during that period of time grew by 13%. So the net growth for the fastest growing religious Christian group in North America was a net 4%. Most groups are way below that. But 4%, if you add it up, folks, is less than 0.5% per year for the fastest growing Christian, major Christian group in North America. Most groups are flatlined or in decline. We in the Churches of Christ are fortunate in that we're not necessarily in decline, though we have slightly fewer members in our churches, according to Mac Lynn, right now than we had in 1990, but we're roughly about the same place. But that's not really that good of news, because again, the population in general has grown 15 or 16% during that time. In Texas, where we almost held our own, the state grew by 4 million. So in the 1990s, we went from 2.25% to 1.75% of the population. Even though we didn't lose any members, we were losing against the onslaught of incoming people. Well, so why plant churches? Because what we're doing now is not getting the job done. That's one reason. I think a second big reason is because of where we're going. And this takes the discussion to another level, but it's an important level for us to talk about, I think, for just a minute. If you have spent any time in the book of Revelation, you know that awesome scene in the throne room where the multitudes of people are gathered before God and before his son Jesus. And there is a group of people who are from every tongue and tribe and nation. That's the end toward which God is committed. This is not something that God has a mild interest in. That is the end toward which God is committed and toward which all of history is bending. And so on the way to that, Jesus told his disciples a couple thousand years ago, go train disciples among all the peoples, right? You've heard a little bit about that this week. And that is the front end of what God ultimately wants to see happen, which is a gathering of all the peoples, all of the pockets of people in the world. He wants a gathering of those folks in his presence forever. Okay, and if that's the goal, if that's the end toward which God is working, if that's the end toward which history is bending, then it seems to me that that has some pretty big implications for church planting. Why plant churches? Because God wants all the peoples reached, and there's lots of peoples right now that are not reached. A third thing that I would say is that around the question of what's going to get us there. And here, I want you to bear with me as I say a couple of weird things to begin with, and then maybe it'll all start to make sense as we get along a little further. I believe the most effective minister in the universe is Jesus Christ. I think he's better than any preacher we've got in Oklahoma or Texas. I think he is the very finest minister in the universe. I think he's the most effective evangelist. I think he does a better job of reaching unreached people than anyone on the planet. I think he's the very best disciple maker. I think he does a better job of taking people from the point of decision for Jesus to mature discipleship. Jesus Christ is the very most effective minister in the universe, and he's absolutely the only one who is capable of building his church. You say, okay, yeah, right. Of course, Kent, that's obvious. But it follows for me that there's nothing as powerfully attractive and effective as Jesus Christ alive and at work in his bride, which is the church. Let me say that again. There's nothing as powerful and attractive as Jesus Christ alive and at work in his bride, the church. When even a couple of us, two or three, are gathered in his name, he's among them in a way that demonstrates his kingdom. So he always sends them out in teams of at least two. In the New Testament, he did. You remember with the 12, he sent them out in twos. He sent them out later on, the 72 in twos. As Paul and Barnabas go out, they go as a pair, and beyond that, They go in groups, in clusters, in clumps, in teams of two or more, because where Christ is present among his people, there is something powerfully and magnetically attractive. Ephesians says, and this is enormously important for some of the other things we're getting ready to say, that the church is built up if and only if each part of the body is doing its work. And we don't have time to unpack some very powerful passages in Ephesians 4 about that. But most of you know that. You have heard that, you've heard that, and you've agreed with that. And we tend to think of each part doing its work as being something related to what we do when we gather in an assembly on a Sunday morning or a specific time of the week. And what I want to suggest is that the kinds of churches that are going to be necessary for the lost people of North America to come into the kingdom are kinds of churches that see the role that each of us has to play as being even bigger than what any of us could do in a one-hour or three-hour slot on a particular day of the week. You have a role to play. I have a role to play. All of us have a role to play in the body of Christ that is absolutely crucial to the body of Christ being formed in an alive and vibrant and attractive way. And so as we get into the subject of what kinds of churches we need to plant, that's going to be really important. You want to say something else?
Yeah, let me build on that a little bit, Kent. If we're saying, which I think we are here, that Jesus is part of our motivation for church planting, not just our motivation, but our modeling for church planting, and if we see what God is up to in the world by looking at Jesus, then I think we have some clues from his life and ministry that might indicate that church planting is pretty important. Let me say it this way. If the way we recognize most clearly what God is up to in the world is by recognizing him in the death and resurrection of Jesus, that's the clearest statement of God's presence among us. And that is a constant rhythm of dying and rising, so that God's purposes for the world are going to be accomplished through people who are committed to that rhythm of living. Let me give you some examples. We know these texts, don't we? Paul says, I am crucified with Christ. Nevertheless, I live, yet not I, but Christ who lives in me. Or we know this one. I want to know Christ and the power of his rising, share in his sufferings, conform to his death, so that somehow I might attain resurrection from the dead. Or we know this one. We always carry about in the members of our flesh the death of Christ, so that the life of Christ might be seen in our members. Just a few verses later, Paul says, so death is at work in us, so that life might be at work in you. This is the script that those who follow Christ live. And not just individually, but communally. As a church, this is the church's script. The church's script is not to gather all life into itself and hoard it and hold on to it. But the church's life is always to be sacrificially emptying for the sake of the world. Not to hoard its resources or pile up its resources or just build bigger barns or just count more noses. But the mission of the church is to follow Christ into the world, to lose it all, to shed it all, to spend it all for the sake of others. That's what God is up to in the world. And that's always what he's calling his people to see the death and resurrection of Jesus as their script for life. And I think that has profound implications for church planning. We're going to talk about that in a few minutes. Where are we in our little script here? So, Kent, let's get started on that then. What does all this that we've said so far have to do with church planning?
Well, I think that question deserves another question. And let me just say this. I want to say this two times because I want you to really get it and think about it for a second. What would it take to have a vibrant family of Jesus Christ within close reach, geographically and culturally, of every North American, what would that take? Let me say it again. What would it take to have a vibrant family of Jesus Christ within close reach, geographically and culturally, of every North American? What would that take? Where people are not only hearing about the gospel or being not only being told some truths about God, but they're actually seeing it lived out in close proximity to the world that they live in. What would it take to get there? Mark, why don't you take off on that for us?
All right. One of the things we want to say is that to get the church there is going to require that the church becomes a better reader of its cultural context. Could you hand these out? Kind of go this room. Randy, would you help me on this side? I don't have enough probably for everyone. We thought we're up against Cope, we're up against Seedman, we're up against who in the world's going to come to our class. So, and those are color copies. They cost a lot of money. That's why you came. You're not going to get that from Cope. I'll just tell you that right now. But what you're about to see is this picture. I want to talk about examining our cultural context here a little bit. This is two pictures of the same thing 25 years apart. 25 years apart. Anybody want to guess what it is? Yeah, somebody got it right off the bat. It's the internet. The picture on the left is the internet Al Gore invented. And notice how simple the picture is and how sequential it is. It's easy to see in that picture kind of where the genesis is, the beginning point, and where the hubs of power are, so that all movement is kind of centralized. Okay. Now, the picture on the right is also a picture of the internet, but it looks like a brain or something, doesn't it? And if you removed any one of those parts, the internet would still function. There's no center anymore. There might be areas with more concentrated activity. But now, instead of living in kind of a cause and effect world, a linear sequential world, kind of a billiard ball world that has kind of pockets and centers of authority and power, we have a picture of a reality that's diffuse, where things are scattered. I want to suggest that this is kind of a parable for the world we live in, and that same 25-year gap could be measured in our churches, in our culture at large. That we used to live in a world where the centers of authority were predictable and the lines of command were easily traced, and churches occupied downtown areas. I don't remember the dates on this, but I read recently where the Atlanta Constitution Journal in the late 60s listed the top 50 citizens of Atlanta in terms of power and authority and influence. And over 20 of them were ministers. 50 in Atlanta, 20 ministers. 20 years later or so, Atlanta Constitution Journal does an article, the top 100 citizens of Georgia. So 50 to 100, Atlanta to Georgia, zero ministers listed. Now, I'm not crying about that. I'm just saying we live in a different world. We used to live in a world that was kind of a, if we build it, they'll come world, where the lines of authority were clear. People understood kind of the social arrangements. And churches could kind of be a place where things happen. George Hunsberger has recently written that kind of the history of the Western church since the Reformation is that churches have seen themselves as a place where certain things happen rather than a people sent on a mission. I want you to think about that. For instance, Luther identified the church as the place where the sacraments are observed and the gospel is preached. Lord's Supper, baptism, preaching. And where those things happen, the church is present. The church is a place where? Well, that's different than seeing the church as a people sent on a mission. And in the history of the West, the church has been seen as a place instead of a people sent. And it's creeped into how we think about everything. Our language betrays us, doesn't it? We go to church. And even though our mothers taught us better, that the church isn't the building, it's the people, right? Didn't your mother teach you that? We still primarily judge and evaluate our church by what happens in the big assembly on Sunday. And I would guess that if you did an audit of energy in your congregational context, most of it is being expended for the maintenance of what happens on Sunday. Church is a place where. And we've improved somewhat by saying that ministry is not just what the clergy does, but it's what everybody does. But my hunch is that if you ask most people, what's your ministry, they would identify it with some function or activity that they do in relationship to what happens at the building. My ministry is serving in the nursery, or my ministry is... We live in a different culture. It's more diffuse. You know as well as I do that people aren't going to show up just because the doors are open anymore. Am I right? I mean, Sundays look like the Marines, the few, the proud, the Marines. And we take some comfort in the fact that where two or three are gathered, Jesus is there in our midst. And I want to say, let's not cry about that. But let's see it like Acts chapter 8, that where the church got decentered and a persecution came and people were scattered all over the place, that suddenly the church was in the opportunity to preach the gospel in ways that it hadn't before. I want to see the scattering of our people, this picture, where people's lives are not just identified by the 3 hours they spend in our building a week, as the sending of the church. And church planning, I think, is an essential rhythm for us to escape this mentality that church is a place where certain things happen rather than a people sent on a mission. Let me just say right now, I think every church ought to have a plan for their next plant. For their next sending into the world, so that the mentality that they develop is not a mentality of hoarding or bigging or bigger or building up more barns, but it is always a mentality of sending. Here's a second point with regard to contextualization within our culture. We live in a postmodern world, and I'm tired of hearing that. I think it's way overdone. But here is the thing that I think is true. Rick referred to this last night when he talked about our whatever culture, that we live in a culture that is suspicious of the big story, the story that tries to account for all of reality. Now, they have a reason for that. And that is because most people who've claimed to know the big story have used it to whack people who don't believe the big story. And so it's seen as any move for a big story is seen simply as a power grab. And our culture is suspicious of anybody who's telling one story to account for all reality because it looks like we're trying to control everybody else. I think the Christian response to that is not to try to grab all the power again, to try to go back to this picture, a more orderly world. But I think the right move is to live the life of Christ, shedding power, shedding privilege, learning to see our life on the margins, it's where God would have us anyway, among the poor, among the oppressed, and to find our vocation again there with the crucified one. And no one will be suspicious of a story that leads people to shed power for the sake of loving people at the margins. And I wish I could say that our churches have done well at that. But the truth is that the most segregated hour in American life is the worship hour on Sundays. The church growth experts have encouraged us to do the homogenous church principle, where we all look alike and think alike and act alike and sound alike. And that's not the mission and vision of God. And so church planting, I think, helps us recover some of that rhythm. It helps churches, again, be committed to a way of life where we're not hoarding power, but shedding power. Where we're not accumulating life, but where, as Randy Harris said yesterday, where we're becoming food for the world. Church planting, I think, is important to that. Kent, I've been talking a lot here.
That's good. That's good. Maybe I would just pick up on that and say one of the obvious implications of what we've just been hearing from Mark is that if I'm going to be on this mission of God that Mark's been describing, this, if I'm going to become a missional person, not a missionary, but a person who is aligned with God's mission in my lifestyle, then it means that I'm going to have to become a better student, not only of the culture, as Mark has been saying, but also a better student of my culture, my specific city, my specific town, my specific suburb. Because my suspicion is that most of us have managed to get to the place in life we are without really being very aware of the mosaic of peoples that are all around us. You don't live anymore in North America. You don't live in a place where it's all just one culture. There are lots and lots of different kinds of people. There's a whole patchwork quilt of kinds of people all around you in the city or the town or the village that you live in. And we tend to see the people that are like us, the folks that we associate with, and we tend to not see all of those other folks that are around us. If we're going to be missional people, then we're going to have to start caring about those pockets of people that we've kind of been oblivious to all this time. Karen and I have got a couple of friends in Austin who kept driving by this apartment complex on their way to work, and the husband turned to the wife one day and said, "You know, I just have this funny feeling that God may want us to do something for the folks that live there." Now, this is a white couple, and this is a largely Hispanic apartment complex. And she said, "Well, you know, I've been having the same kind of feeling. Let's just take some time next week and go over there and walk around, pray about these people and see what happens." So they did that, and they did it again a week later, and they did it for several months. And one day while they were out there, a rainstorm came. And so they ducked under the eave over one of the apartments, and there's a couple of women, middle-aged women standing there. And they got to talking, and before you know it, they had a Bible study set up with those folks. And before you know it, those folks had invited them into their home, and before you know it, there was a church meeting in that apartment complex. Well, that's what I'm talking about, becoming awake to the people that God loves that are living right next door to you that maybe we haven't been seeing for a long time. Becoming aware of the fact that it's on God's heart to reach all of the people of your city, not just the people that are just like you, not just the people that have always gone to church or that are in the circles that we're the most comfortable in. So I think that's another key thing. You want to dive in on that one?
Let me jump in. Let me look at this again. We have conceived of church life in ways that fit this picture more than this picture. Okay, That's natural. It's probably the way we should have done it, because it was the right contextual response then. So that we can scarcely imagine what church life is like in a different way. And I just want to say that church plants give us the opportunity for us to learn from some alternative ways of doing church without the disruption that comes with trying to change an existing church that's already negotiated patterns of power and doing and living and being. That church plants then can be leaven for the rest of us. For instance, I think that that we could examine kind of the history of the church in the West as a move from altar to stage. Now, I don't want that to sound pejorative, because I think there are great things that happen because we have great pulpiteers and because we have great worship leaders that can inspire us and lead us into the presence of God. But I'm just saying, architecturally, our churches were once prominent for their altars and now are prominent for their stages, and I think church plants could recover the table in ways that existing churches just can't. I mean, I go to Highland and Abilene, and I think about how in the world could a family this large on Sunday mornings recover a vital sense of table in our corporate assemblies, and it just makes me crazy. But church plants could, and then we could learn from them, and we could all benefit then from one more thing. Let me say another thing here before I give the microphone back to Kent. That the church does very precious little teaching and modeling for people how to think of their life in the workplace and in their communities as ministry. We just do very little. I was really guilty of that. This picture requires it of us, so that where our people are in their workplaces and in their communities, instead of bemoaning the fact that our people are spending more time there than they used to, say, this is the sending of our people into the world, and that these are the beachheads for the kingdom of God that are being established, and doing everything we can to reverse the flow of church so that our leadership systems get there, so that our worship systems get there, so that our evangelistic systems get there, so that there's truly empowering of the church. And I think church plants do that better than the way that we've organized our church life to this point.
Let me just add on to what he's saying there. Missionaries have a name for a kind of church planting overseas that's called extractionist church planting. And what it means is that you take people out of the culture that they're a part of, and you haul them off into your culture. Often we've done that in the styles of church even that we do. So we bring, you know, Stamps Baxter songs to Africa. You know, well, hey, you know, I love Stamps Baxter songs. I enjoy Now Let Us Have a Little. You know, but that may not be the most effective way for an African Christian to communicate to another African Christian about their faith. And so when we think about what would it be like to reach North America, we can apply some principles that missionaries have understood overseas for a long time, but that we're just now beginning to pay attention to in North America. That is, what if when we lead someone to Jesus, we don't ask them to come from the world that they live in, from the network of friendships that they share, from the guys that they hang out with at the basketball game, or the women that they enjoy knitting with, or whatever happens to be the sphere of their world, and haul them over into our world. But instead, God launches a new church in that family. Now, wouldn't that kind of look like it looked in the New Testament? Peter didn't ask Cornelius to come on down to the synagogue. A church started in the household of Cornelius. Peter didn't ask Lydia to come and be a part of another group that was foreign to her. But he went and lived, Paul went and lived in Lydia's home, and a church grew up in Philippi that was made up of those folks that were a part of that culture. So what would that be like? Well, it sounds kind of scary because, well, if we're not drawing them into our circles, then how does their contribution help our bottom line in the budget? And how does their attendance help our attendance? Well, that may be asking the wrong question.
Well, and I just want you to know, Kent, that when you church planners start talking this way, I do just say, you're crazy, man. That's just foolishness. And I've been, you know, I prepared many, spent a lot of money for a graduate education that trained me for ministry for a place, if we build it, you'll come. And I know what to do there. But I don't know what to do with this model of church. I went and hung out with Tilly Bergen in Arlington, Texas, one weekend recently. And they have a church planning thing where they meet in apartments all over the city of Arlington, Fort Worth, and Dallas. And where does the church meet? Wherever someone is baptized, church meets there. And so there might be a cluster of four or five families in an apartment complex. And what does Tilly call it? They hang out and they hover and, yeah. They hover and they do John 3:16. I mean, it's really simple. And it dawned on me, hanging out with them, how complex we've made everything. How incredibly complex we've made church life. And the church planning people, who I still think 50% of them are crazy, loony. Kent's one of the. No, I'm.
I get to talk next.
When they talk, I just think you guys are turning the world upside down. But what's been remarkable to me is how often they talk about how simple organisms divide and complex organisms die. And I think we've got to recover something of that, of the movement. You know, Tilly always says, no one ever said in the Bible, come to church. But it always says in the Bible, go and be the church. And I don't know how we recover all of that, but we've lost a sense of movement, I think, that we need to recover for our health. I'm writing a book right now with two of my colleagues at ACU on the nature of the church. And we're calling the book, Leaving the Land We Know. Because the church is most often faithful when it's crossing boundaries and new horizons, leaving the land that we knew for the new adventure of finding God in a different place and in a new culture and in a different historical circumstance. And it's when the church gets settled that there are all kinds of temptations that attach themselves to the church, where we think we deserved all this. We built this with our own hands, and somehow we've got to recover the movement of the church leaving the land we know. Church planting is not the only way to do that. I'm just saying it's an essential way for us to do that now.
The hangout and hover concept brings up another point about this. In terms of what it's going to mean for us, it's going to require us to get involved with different kinds of people than we have been accustomed to getting involved with, and in different kinds of ways. Karen and I were in Oxford, England for the year 2002, and one of my vivid memories of that time was sitting in the living room of some folks there in Oxford who were amazing, because in that living room were church leaders who had been 7 years ago homeless, who had been addicted to drugs. There was a wife who had been a prostitute of one of the key leaders who had been strung out on drugs. And there was a guy that was a ex-Cambridge guy that had brilliant mind but had just totally lost it with addictions. But these guys are maturing leaders in the church at this point, 5 years, 10 years from that time. Well, how did that happen? You know, to me, when you see people coming from deep lostness to a profound leadership in the kingdom of God, something right has happened there. And what happened was that some people hung out and hovered with those folks. They invested their life in people. Now, we in North America would love for everything to be possible to be done as simple and as hassle-free a way as possible. We'd love to be able to crank out hamburgers in 30 seconds. You go to the window and ask what you want, and 30 seconds later it pops out. We'd like to do that with discipleship, but you know what, folks? It ain't going to happen. You cannot fine-tune the machine of a church so well that it will ultimately, you can take unbelievers, pop them in one end, and pop them out on the other end as mature disciples of Jesus. That ain't going to happen. And we've tried it for a lot of years now, and I think the net result is pretty clear at this point. That's not going to happen. Well, what is it going to take? It's going to take a bunch of us getting down and dirty with people and spending time investing our lives in their lives. That's how it's going to happen. In fact, I would suggest to you that that's how it has always happened. You can make converts through cool programs, but to train disciples of Jesus Christ who are passionately invested in their love for God, who are becoming like Jesus in character, and are moving in the power of the gifts of the Spirit and in the power of the uniqueness that God has made them to be, to serve Him in His kingdom, those kinds of people come one way, and the one way is through a commitment of our life in somebody else's life. And that's a lifelong project. It's a lifetime project to be able to do that. So I think the bottom line is it's going to take a lot more of us doing a lot more of that. Let me say one last thing on this whole question of how would we get to a vibrant family of Jesus in close reach of every North American. I would suggest that it would take lots more churches than we've got right now. I love what's going on with Stadia. I love what's going on with a number of other groups inside the Churches of Christ and our sister churches. Stadia is dreaming of 5,500 new churches by the year 2025.
Okay, what's Stadia? I don't know.
Stadia is an organization within the Christian churches. Some of you have probably heard of it, some of you haven't, that has said we would partner with Churches of Christ. People from the Churches of Christ, we'd be happy for you to establish your congregation that's non-instrumental in its practice. We would be happy to come alongside you and provide training and give you money to help you get started if you're qualified and called by God to do this. And so but that's a wonderful vision of 5,500 new churches. But friends, you remember the numbers we were talking about a little earlier, 232 million folks out there who hadn't made it to church. Well, that's going to call for hundreds of thousands, millions of new churches. And so we've got to come up with a way to envision that, if that's what God's up to, that enables us to grow churches a lot faster and a lot more powerfully than anything that I think most of us have envisioned.
Our colleague Randy Harris is helping us dream about all of this. Randy's really committed to the notion of the need to plant churches. Randy teaches probably more undergraduate students at ACU than probably anyone. He has these large sections of undergraduate Bible that he teaches. And Randy says that he's changed his vocabulary in class. He used to say, when you go home to your churches. And now he says, when you plant your church. And it's that kind of movement that we need to instill among those in our churches, to say, when you plant your church, or to say, when we plant as a congregation our next church. You know, this is one of the, I may be getting ahead of ourselves, but while Kent's passing out documents here, one of the great fears we have is that if we hive off members of our congregation to start another church, that our church will become weaker. And I just want to say, we've got to trust God there. And the churches that do find that this kind of dying and rising ethic that they have, where they're willing to risk the life of that church for the sake of the world, that God honors that. And churches that are hiving off new churches all the time find themselves wonderfully caught up into the sustaining power of God. And again, this is why I'm committed to church planting, is to recover a sense of the mission of God with regard to the death and resurrection of Jesus, so that we understand our lives in relationship to letting go and relinquishing, and that we build that in at the expectation level among our teenagers and among our college students and among our church populations as a whole, that say, when we plant our next church, when I'm a part of a church plant, I'm going to, that becomes the language that kind of seasons our churches.
I think there are obviously a lot of questions that a conversation like this raises for people. And we knew we weren't going to be able to cover all those questions in the length of time we have here. But I have sent around to you a list of some readings that might introduce you to some of the issues, give you a chance to follow up further and ask some of the questions that maybe have been coming to mind. And certainly Mark and I would be happy to visit with you personally about that as well. We're almost to the end of the time here. Let me just mention two questions that likely do come to your mind. One is, don't we already have enough churches in our city? And maybe this is a problem for those pagan northern states, but us people down here in the South, we don't have that problem. Let me give you two quick things to think about. Who are the people that are already represented in your churches? Who are the groups of people that are already represented in your churches? If you pay attention to those folks and then notice who are all the other groups of people in your city, you'll probably notice there's some folks that aren't in your churches. In Abilene, one of the most churched small cities in North America, 145 churches and 100,000 plus folks. A student of mine did some research for me a few years back and found out that if we filled every church to capacity two times every Sunday morning, maybe 45,000 folks or so in Abilene would be in church on a given Sunday. Well, that leaves another 55,000 in one of the most church small cities in America. More likely, your town, your city is more like Irving, Texas, buckle of the Bible Belt, right between Dallas and Fort Worth. A friend of mine recently did the study there. 200,000 people in Irving on a given Sunday morning, maybe 15,000 in church. There aren't enough churches in our cities. There aren't enough churches in our towns. Lots of people, maybe they're folks in an old folks home, maybe they're folks who are new agers, maybe there's some folks who are in gangs, maybe there's some folks in the drug culture. You list, you find, you pay attention to the pockets of people in your city. And I believe Jesus wants to plant a vibrant family that will reflect his character and his glory among those folks. Thanks for your kind attention in a warm room. I pray that God will bless you as you think about these things further. And thank you for giving Mark and I the privilege to be with you.
And vote for us for best handouts, okay? Thanks.